Welcome to the June edition of our podcast. This month, we're joined by Eric Steiner of OFW Law for an inside look at the latest developments on the reconciliation funding bill currently making its way through Congress. We also take you behind the scenes of the National Wheat Foundation's annual Wheat Farm Tour. Hear firsthand insights from host Billy Willard and NWF board member Carl Schwenke as they share key insights from this year's event. Tune in to stay connected and informed on what's happening in ag policy and the wheat community. I'm joined today by Eric Steiner, Senior Policy Advisor at OFW Law, a mid-sized law firm in DC specializing in food, agriculture, and international trade. Eric brings a deep expertise in food, agriculture, and trade policy, helping his clients navigate the complex landscape of the U.S. Congress and federal agencies like USDA, FDA, EPA, and USDR to achieve their business and humanitarian goals. He previously served on the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, working under Chairman Thad Cochran, Saxby Chambliss, and Pat Roberts. He also did a brief stint at the National Association of Wheat Growers before rejoining the Senate Ag Committee under Chairman Roberts. Today, Eric and the OFW team support NOG's government relations team as NOG expands their capacity. Eric, it's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me.
So to start us off, could you introduce yourself and share how you came to be involved with NOG?
Sure. Maybe just start from scratch. You know, I'm a farm kid from Indiana. I grew up on a small, diversified crop and livestock farm, and occasionally we'd grow some red winter wheat. I went to Purdue for ag education. I was pretty hyperactive in FFA. My mom came from generations of teachers, my dad from generations of farmers. So to go become an ag teacher just seemed to make sense for me. And when I worked on the Senate Ag Committee, I did a farm bill. And then I was asked to serve as a political appointee at USDA for the George W. Bush administration. I was going to law school at night, which was a little insane, but I had a semester to go when the administration ended. And I was hired as a law clerk at the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. I was there for about a year and a half. And then at the time, the legislative director for Senator Roberts was Mike Seifert, originally from Kansas. And he helped me get a job at NOG. And I served as the director of farm programs and international trade. And I loved it. But I was at NOG for all of 9 months. And then Senator Roberts became the new ranking member on the Senate Ag Committee. Mike became the new staff director for the Republicans, and he invited me back on the Ag Committee to do another farm bill. We kind of laugh to say, you know, both my kids were born three farm bills ago. It's kind of how we measure life in our family. But after that, I did in-house government affairs for Kraft Foods and Elanco Animal Health, and also the American Forest and Paper Association. And now I'm completing my first year at OFW Law, where I'm happy to be helping out again with NOG.
Well, we are very happy to have someone helping us out with such extensive background. So as you know, there's a lot happening in Washington right now, but getting a long-term farm bill signed into law still remains one of the top priorities for our wheat growers. We know that many of NOG's policy priorities have been reflected in the reconciliation funding bill that currently is working its way through Congress. Can you walk us through what has happened so far in the legislative process and where things currently stand with that legislation?
Yeah, the budget reconciliation process undertaken right now in Congress, otherwise known as the President's Big Beautiful Bill, is in full swing. The House passed their version in May, and now it's with the Senate. And the Senate Ag Committee released their proposal for reconciliation on Wednesday, June 11th. And as of today, the time we're filming this, the Senate aims to vote on Wednesday, June 25th. Then the House will need to pass the Senate's version again in time for President Trump's goal to sign it on or before July 4th. Now, there's not a lot of time to complete the work, as both the House and Senate are expected to be off the week of June 30th for the July 4th holiday. Now, as for NOG's farm bill priorities included in the House passed bill and the Senate Ag Committee's proposal, there's a lot to like for wheat growers. NOG's first goal is to enhance the farm safety net. The House passed bill and the Senate Ag Committee proposals would both increase Title I safety net spending by over $49 billion over 10 years, primarily through increases to reference prices and crop insurance. For example, here's a graphic published by my colleague John Newton, a terrific ag economist at Terrain. The Senate Ag Committee proposal would make a substantial boost to Title I commodity programs like PLC and ARC for the 2025 crop year. Here, this shows how PLC reference prices would change under the proposal. This would be a boost for the farm economy given elevated input costs and projections for flat to lower crop prices. NOC's second Farm Bill goal is to support the voluntary conservation. For conservation, reconciliation is expected to provide additional baseline and mandatory funding of about $3 billion over 10 years for the four major working lands conservation programs, including EQIP and CSP. There's also additional funds of about $100 million over 10 years proposed for the Voluntary Public Access and Habitat Incentive Program. And the third Farm Bill goal for NOG is to develop market opportunities. For market development programs to help facilitate international trade opportunities, the Senate Ag proposal would includes $2 billion over 10 years starting in 2026. Now, for all of reconciliation, there's in the Senate what we call the Byrd Rule considerations. Reconciliation bills enjoy special procedural privileges in the Senate, as it's not subject to the 60-vote threshold to overcome a filibuster. It only takes 50 votes out of 100, and the vice president breaks the tie. Just as FYI, in the House, there is no tiebreaker. If it is a tie vote, they have to keep going until they can break it. But in the Senate, the Byrd Rule exists to help ensure provisions considered under the privileged reconciliation process are limited to decreases and increases in the federal budget, and non-budgetary policy changes are not permitted. Policy provisions can be attempted, but objections on the Senate floor can be raised and would be found in order, and the provisions would be stricken from the bill before final passage. Again, at this point, as we're filming this, the various Senate committees, including agriculture, are meeting with the Senate parliamentarian to ensure their proposals can survive challenges on the Senate floor under the Byrd Rule. As an example, we just learned this morning the Senate parliamentarian rejected a couple of key items in the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, and they'll need to be stricken because they won't pass muster under the Byrd Rule. So we'll see whether the Ag Committee's spending priorities will survive any Byrd Rule challenges and whether some proposals will need to be considered in a later farm bill. An example of this is the proposal to move Food for Peace, or International Food Aid, from the State Department to USDA. Since this is more of a policy change, not a budget change, it would not likely survive a Byrd Rule challenge. So there's an effort underway right now to move Food for Peace to USDA in the appropriations process, or it could be considered in a future farm bill.
So you mentioned that President Trump was aiming to get this bill signed into law around the 4th of July period. Given your, extensive background on Capitol Hill in the Senate Ag Committee, how likely do you think that that timing is to happen? And do you think that all of NOG's policy priorities will be included in that final version of the bill?
This reconciliation bill is a Republican-led process. They don't expect any Democrats to support it, and the Republicans therefore haven't allowed Democrats to help shape it. You can understand that's led to a lot of raw nerves on the Democrat side of the aisle. The Ag Committee Republicans have attempted to include larger spending items in reconciliation to make it easier, theoretically, from a budget perspective, to pass a budget-neutral farm bill in the future. However, from a political perspective, making big cuts to the SNAP program to pay for these increases in farm programs may make it harder to muster a bipartisan majority to pass a future farm bill. Now, over time, farm bills really have needed a bipartisan support to overcome the 60-vote filibuster in the Senate, and with such small margins of majority in the House and the Senate, and there's always a number of far-right Republicans and far-left Democrats who will never vote for any farm bill. So it's really necessary to have that strong bipartisan support in the middle to be able to pass a farm bill at all. So again, we'll see if the farm bill proposals will survive reconciliation, but there is expected already to be what some are terming a skinny farm bill that'll need to be passed after reconciliation to capture all the other priorities that are being considered in a normal farm bill.
Thank you for walking us through that. So, lastly, as this process continues to unfold, is there anything else our producers, should be looking out for or be aware of?
Yeah, another item we're keeping an eye on are the potential for how retaliatory tariffs may affect growers' bottom line. And as mentioned earlier, the proposal to move Food for Peace to USDA and to help ensure that it provides in-kind food aid. Those are a couple of things we're watching of many. But again, very happy to be working with NOG again and helping out in any way we can.
Next, we have the host of this year's farm tour, Billy Willard, owner of Willard Farms in Poolesville, Maryland, and CEO of Willard AgriScience. Billy is a third-generation farmer and Purdue grad. He blends tradition with innovation using precision agriculture to steward land that has been in his family since 1871. He's also a leader in the ag community, serving on multiple boards and continuing a legacy that earned his family a spot in the Maryland Governor's Agriculture Hall of Fame. Billy, it's a pleasure to be with you here on your farm today. Thank you for hosting this year's farm tour. This is such a beautiful setting and a great opportunity to learn more about your farm and the work that you do here.
Well, I sure wish we could have bought better weather for today because it is hot, but it is the end of June. Yeah, we're happy to host and happy to have our guests come from D.C. Those that don't understand what we do and are eager to learn about what we do. Our farm in Montgomery County dates back to 1871, when two brothers moved down from Burkittsville in Frederick County and purchased 675 acres near the C&O Canal so they could ship goods and also receive goods in. Fast forward the canal, one broke, and the railroad came through, and I'm sure my ancestors thought, well, that probably wasn't a great idea. So the operation did evolve from a traditional family farm where everything was grown. The food was grown, everything was grown. Excess, that you know, they put it on canal or they would sold it in town. The next generation of that Willard family actually ventured out into new endeavors, seeing that there was probably not the greatest opportunity on the farm, especially where it was located and especially soil types. My great-grandfather, Harry Willard, went into the custom farming business. And so he had steam engines, he had thrash machines, he had a mobile sawmill, and that's how he made a living. And my father got the bug from hanging with Harry Willard, his grandfather, in terms of agriculture and custom farming, and agriculture in general. And that's when my father just decided that's what he was going to do for the rest of his life.
Well, it is so cool to see how much your farm, you know, has changed over the years. So what inspired you to open up your farm today to congressional staff, USDA officials, and academic leaders?
Well, as you probably know, there's a whole lot less farmers on this planet than there was even just 10 or 15 years ago. And it's probably, that issue is probably exaggerated a little bit more here in Montgomery County. A land mass of about 280,000. There's 1.1 million residents, and there's not a lot that know and understand ag. Same thing in the national arena in D.C. There's just not a lot of folks in Congress that have agrarian backgrounds. So we have to do this. We've got to shut down, slow down, and educate folks on what we do.
So can you give our listeners an overview of, you know, what have you been, you know, demonstrating and teaching participants today?
Well, first and foremost, we want them to understand how the crops are grown, and they're grown with precision. And with the technology we have today, we can produce a bushel of corn with less inputs than we did only 15 years ago, just because of the precision application, the soil testing, tissue sampling, et cetera, et cetera. We also talked about soil conservation and no-till and how important no-till is countrywide, but especially around the Chesapeake Bay. It's just critical that we don't have any dirt move off the field.
So do you have any standout moments that you want to share from today or anything else that you think is important for listeners to know about today's event?
Well, I was excited and happy that our Secretary of Ag showed up. And I didn't have any belief he wouldn't, but you know, Kevin Addicks is great. He's a champion for ag. And he's always in the field doing great things for agriculture. But we have a really big, long road to hoe with the folks that we need to continue to educate.
Well, thank you for taking the time to sit down and speak with me today. And I think today, you know, has been such a success and largely to the part of your generosity and your teams.
Thank you.
Next were its idea from Carr Schwenke, a longtime leader in the grain industry and valued board member of the National Wheat Foundation. Carl brings over 40 years of experience, including more than three decades at Seymour Milling Company, where he served as vice president of grain supply. In that role, he oversaw wheat and co-product risk management of three flour mills. Carl has also held leadership roles with the National Grain and Feed Association and served on the executive committee of the U.S. Wheat and Barley Scab Initiative. Today, he joins us to talk about one of the National Wheat Foundation's most important annual events.
Carl, it's great to be here with you today. The National Wheat Foundation's Farm Tour is one of the foundation's largest, most impactful educational events. Can you walk us through what is happening today at Willard Farms?
Well, part of today's program that we had today is that we wanted to take people out into a wheat field. Today is Today is June 24th, and we're in the middle of wheat harvest in Maryland. And it's a very hot day here, but that's the environment that farmers are working in, no matter whether it's hot, cold, rainy, or dry. When the wheat's ready, they have to go out and get it. And that's what we're here to show people firsthand, that this is the process that has to take place. So we've tried to bring that to the group. We've tried to bring some of the other events and other factors that go into raising that crop, and then talk about some of the marketing aspects and some of the governmental policies and programs that affect farmers, and how that how the legislative process needs to be aware of those issues that are going on out here in the field. Well, today, as part of our education mission with the National Wheat Foundation, our goal here is to educate DC staffers into the role of agriculture and some of the agriculture issues that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. There's a lot of things going on in DC, and people are making policy, people are making decisions. They're deciding some things that are gonna happen to agriculture that could affect us for a long time. And part of our role is to make sure that the people helping to make those decisions are educated in what's going on in today's modern agriculture.
What has been your role today in supporting this year's tour?
Well, my role is to bring the milling perspective to the group here, because everything that we make in the field and grow in the field has to come to the table at some point. And so it's our role to help people understand that the process that brings that from the field to the consumer into their food every day is safe, is efficient, and is economical. And we want people to understand that that's what today's modern agriculture is doing for us.
You touched on a little bit of this earlier, but why do you think it's so important that we bring congressional staff and federal officials out to a wheat farm during harvest?
Well, surprisingly, and maybe not surprisingly, but many people just don't know where food comes from. And every bit of our food at some point was grown in the ground or as an animal brought to the market and brought to the store for consumers to buy. And we can't lose sight of that fact. That's that fact that it's a noble profession. It's something that is very important to us. Food security, by far. We talk about many of the things that are important to the country, but food security is one of the key factors of how we are able to be as strong as we are. We don't depend on anybody else for our food, and we need to make sure we keep it that way.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about this year's farm tour or the broader goals of the National Wheat Foundation's educational programs?
Well, we just continue on with what we're doing. We need to, at some point you think it's just one person at a time, but we need to make sure that people are aware of the impact that wheat has in our diet, that wheat has in our economy, and wheat has in feeding the world, because much of our wheat that's grown here is also sent to other countries that cannot. We are a land of abundance here, and our land is able us to produce more than what we need, and we're able to share that with the world. And I think that's a key part of what we're doing here at the National Wheat Foundation.
Thanks for listening to the June podcast. Make sure to keep up with us on social media and our website at weworld.org.